Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is episode number 9 of the Driving Eureka podcast. This week's feature article is about innovation project waste. Our Driving Eureka book segment is about the increasing pace of change in business. And our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy will cover key secrets and also the craft cocktail recipe, the Sazerac. So this week, Doug, we're going to talk in segment 1 about how to stop innovation project waste. And we've touched on this on and off over a few of the episodes. But 50% of value is wasted and lost on the front end of innovation. How does that happen?
First off, let me just say, I specifically said stopping project waste, because we have a fixation on planet Earth in the corporate suite that if we just cut costs, a miracle will occur. And so because we want to get rid of waste, and I agree with waste. But if we're going to get rid of waste, let's get rid of the real waste, the stuff that is really wasting our time and energy. And the number one thing that's doing that is our development process. And yes, we've talked about it. Most waste, where the companies lose things, is in their development. Their project management system that they use to manage projects is causing them to lose value. They're just losing value. They're losing profitability because of the way their system of project management works when it comes to innovations. So the classic approach to managing projects is a process where you define the idea and you define the requirements and the tasks that you have to complete, and then you assign them to people, you check on conformance to requirements, and that's how you manage your project.
So this is a software development process, basically.
Software development or project management, it's all the same.
Okay.
And the latest hot thing now is to have project managers. That's going to help it. It doesn't help it. It doesn't help it at all.
No, it doesn't. Because the project managers only wind up asking you, what's the date for your task?
That's right. And then they send out reports.
Yes.
And they generate – they're very good report generators.
And their critical path.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay.
And they draw charts.
Yep. Gantt charts.
Now, to be fair, a bunch of these folks are awesome, and when I have spent time with them, they're very, very frustrated because they know the system doesn't work on innovation. And in fact, a number of them have said to me, let me tell you the secret to my success as a project manager. Don't get on innovation projects. Get on deployment projects. Get on rebuilds. Get on things where there isn't high uncertainty. Manage projects that have been done before, and you'll be fine. When you're managing an innovation, there's uncertainty associated with it. And so the project management, conformance to requirements, blows up.
Well, yeah. And this is exactly – this is what you see in software development, right? Like you said, you want to be the project manager that has one that's a kind of a predictable something that's happened before. Because otherwise, the thing that management pays attention to is the date that it's due. So – in uncertainty, how can you give a date?
That's right. And so when you don't have the date, the software turns you now from green to red.
Yep.
And an alert, I mean, if it's software they really like, alerts go to your boss and your boss's boss that you're off schedule and you're the cause of it. Hmm. And so what happens is that when these red flags come up, the person who's on a bind, they go, can't do it. Guess can't do it. We're going to have to compromise. So rather than go for that 3-1 product win. Now we go to a 60-40. And the next thing you go, we go to, well, we're 52-48. Well, actually, we're no different than anybody else. Our big new idea is no much better than anybody else's. It used to be, but we couldn't hit the timetable, so we had to compromise. And then the thing fails, and 95% of the time we fail, and we don't understand why it happened. It's in the damn system, for crying out loud.
Okay. So you guys have looked at this and said, this just doesn't work for especially innovation. And so you've come up with an alternative approach.
Yeah. So getting frustrated by this, mm-hmm. I'm talking really frustrated. We decided to start to look at it. And as I said, I spent a bunch of time with project management people, some really good people, and talked to them about it. And we started to track the data on projects in labs, because we've got like $17 billion worth of projects in active development. We can follow them week by week. And so we started to look at where do these things happen? What's going on? And what we found was that on the high uncertainty tasks, at the front end of innovation, people ran rapid cycles of learning, plan, do, study, act, or fail fast, fail cheap, or whatever you want to call it, okay, up at the front. But once they got into development, they assumed they knew all the answers. It's what's called the waterfall approach. Now just execute. And so what we did is we took those cycles of learning from the front and we applied them all the way to market. And so we built a human work system as well as a digital software project management system that we call Trailblazer, and designed it so that when you got to a cycle that had an uncertainty, you ran plan, do, study, act cycles of learning to dissolve the barrier. In other words, we built into it a flexibility. So we had accountability, but we still had flexibility built into the work system and doing it. So when somebody said, I don't know, we're going to have to figure it out, nobody flipped out and said, well, what do we, can't you do your job? And what we found is instead of a 50% decline in ideas through development, we were seeing a growth of 28%, or basically 50 plus 28, 78% growth in ideas during development.
So why is that?
Because they're able to do the cycles of learning. In other words, we're accepting the fact that innovations are innovations. We haven't done them before. They're new to the world. We're going to have to try some things. And if you don't have that, if it's not just do your job, get it done, and you can't experiment anymore, then you compromise. Because people aren't going to keep that red flag on their with their name beside it without doing something about it.
That makes sense. Yeah. So you've built in essence saying, hey, we're going to have to go through some cycles, but I still think that the difficulty, Doug, would be that you don't know how many cycles you're going to go through. When do you stop? When do you say, well, that's good enough? Or does the schedule dictate that? Or what's happening?
What you have to do is you have to work the whole. So that's why you have to have a project leader. And again, this gets back to the changing of the cycle. It's moving to the Toyota chief engineer or the Procter & Gamble brand manager, where there's a person in the middle. When we say, okay, Fred's having troubles on this thing. It's not working. It's not working for Fred. The technology's not working. The metal won't do what we want it to do. The chemistry's not working. Okay, what else can we do? And then they work together to adapt, and they might change the offering or make adjustments in other areas to make the whole thing come together. Or sometimes you decide it's not going to work. We got to kill the project. I mean, that is something that should and it should happen probably more than it does.
So when is that point? I mean, could you, you know, is there a rule of thumb associated with that when you say enough's enough?
No, it's a benefit reward. When the benefit reward is this, you know, if the thing can make me $1 billion, I can take a lot of time to get to $1 billion.
Ah.
If it's going to make me $1.95, you know, I got maybe about 5 minutes.
Okay. So it's the economics of it, basically, or the financials associated.
The risk reward. The risk reward.
Okay. So what? Tell us about the software that the team has put together, the innovation engineering Trailblazer. What does it do?
Well, what's cool about it is it's both a flat file. You know, you've seen your typical, you know, like spreadsheet type list with names, who's assigned, what time do they do it, and you click a button and it draws an automatic Gantt chart. pretty classical project management type platform. Only in addition to having that, it has to have the tasks. It also has what we call the yellow card. It says, who's the customer? What's the problem? What's the promise? What's the proof? And then on top of that, it has the blue card. Strategically, why does the company want to do it?
Okay.
Because one of the things we found is that people working on projects, we go, why are you doing it? I don't know. Why does the customer care? I don't know. Why is it important to the company? I don't know. Well, you can't do your job if you don't know what that's going to be. I mean, Dr. Deming said famously with a bunch of Ford employees, he said, an employee can't do their job if they don't know to what purpose the customer is going to put the product. And so we connect you vertically to the company's, why it's important strategically, why it's important to the customer, and now what are we doing? And then on top of that, we allow you the flexibility that when an idea comes up that doesn't have certainty to it, that you can run plan, do, study, act cycles very quickly. And we've embedded all of the tools right there in the software. So you can do it right there. Sometimes you can do it right there at the team meeting. It makes team meetings incredibly fun. Hmm. And then lastly, so one is the alignment. Second is the PDSA. The third thing it does is it has a really, really simple system to keep everybody connected. So whenever you run those PDSAs, you click a button and it goes to the news feed. Or if you have a task, you've got a challenge, you put a note in the news feed. And then the other people on the team can get it once a day, twice a day, whatever they want. They get one news feed. They get an email that says everything associated with the project, what's going on and what things. So there's no typing up notes. There's no memos. There's none of that junk is gone. I mean, we've just gotten rid of all of that wasted energy that goes on because we're seeing it on a real-time basis. Enter it once, and it takes care of everything for you.
Okay. And so what does the ThinkStormer do in association with that then?
Well, that's what's all been built into ThinkStormer. That's all ThinkStormer.
Okay. All right.
That's how ThinkStormer's built.
Okay. And then the project manager, let's just take a common project manager, the one you think of today. What type of skill set do they need to bring to the table in order to become an innovation project manager using the software? I mean, is it a big leap for them?
In our case, what happens is that we got to have people that own the work. Hmm. Okay. So distant third party project managers, are not helpful to me.
Got you.
I mean, they're just basically people who spank people and do charts.
Yeah. And ask for dates.
What we need is project leaders who are the project leader, who are close to the work, who understand the customer, they understand the trade-offs, they understand the technology, they understand the economics, they understand the patent potential, and they're trading off these dimensions. That's why small businesses can do well and the startups do well, is because the founder or the leader keeps all of those things in. They're playing whack-a-mole with all those components.
Hmm. So is this a skill set then that you have to make, or is this one that...
Oh, you can teach it.
You can't teach it. Okay.
That's why we have courses. And you take the classes and you can do it. I mean, you got to care. And if you care, you can make this work.
Okay. All right. Any other comments associated with the project waste, innovation project waste? Okay.
No, it's just you got to change your mindset. You just got to change your mindset on how you're approaching it. And conformance to requirements and beating people up for not getting things on time when it has uncertainty they don't know, that's not fair, it's not right, and it's not productive.
Okay, very good. All right, well, let's move on to segment two here. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book excerpt with legendary inventor Doug Hall. The Driving Eureka book excerpt. It's not a theory. The pace of business has really changed. Well, what would Deming say about that, Doug?
Well,
about theory, right? I mean, no theory is ever proven, right?
Yeah. So, in the past, there was little urgency to change on what we did. I mean, you could take time. And I think part of our problem as a culture is whether it's in our universities and how we teach, whether it's in government or whether it's in business, is that these new digital things are making connections for people and making things happen much faster than they ever did before. And in the past, you could create an idea and you could say, okay, I guess I got to innovate. Okay, got that done. Thank God I don't have to think about that.
You may not need to excuse yourself there, Doug.
I know. It's just that's the way we think it. And over the careers of many of the senior leaders, it was not uncommon for life cycles to last long times, years, generations. But the fact of the matter is today, the world is truly going faster. And this is the best of times, as I'm prone to say. The best of times. Because it means that old farts who don't change die. Because that's what happens and should happen to old people. Well, maybe not should happen, but you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
There is opportunity to reinvent everything today if you're willing to change the rules and to change the game and to innovate. You know, you got to do something that is, as we've said, meaningfully unique. Go back a couple episodes and we talked about how to measure it. If you're not unique, you got to be cheap. And business doesn't last forever anymore. And this is a good thing for those people who have the mindset to truly, as the title says, drive Eureka in their lives, in their nonprofits, in the for-profits, or however they're making a career. And you can't just, you know, put us, you know, there's a big design stuff. I love design. I love great design. But sometimes people say, well, if we just make it look prettier, maybe that'll make them do it. No, it's the internet will call you out on it. People are going to know. They know when you have a difference that makes a difference and when you don't have a difference. And this is a good thing for innovators. And if you're not an innovator, it's horrific.
So when you look at just kind of the landscape of people, and I know you consider yourself kind of the innovation one percenter, if you will, that would be my word for it. But when you look, do you see, I mean, you think of Steve Jobs, right? I mean, as far as, you know, an innovator, somebody out there who thought differently about things, but it's the exception, not the rule. So, and that's a huge problem for even the pace of change. Certainly younger generation, like what I reference as the digital natives, the people that have always had computers, you know, that are out there, and they're able to make adjustments and change faster. I'm sure that's been true for every generation. You know, in the past, oh, you know, there were cars, and then there were, you know, something else, airplanes, and so you're going through that. So how you've got this whole population of people, and I know you've talked in the past about, you know, the old baby boomers are dying off and they're the ones drinking the whiskey. And that's why you got to do new ones. But how do you make it?
Trip. I'm going to give them some space here.
Okay.
I actually think, because I really, really think if we're going to really thrive as a society and as a culture, because we got a lot of big problems we got to solve, we're going to have to work together. And that includes, we need the wisdom of the elders. We truly do. And I'm not going to beat them up to say, hey, you idiot, why don't you believe in innovating? Why aren't you proactive? Why are you just reactive? Why are you just worrying about your retirement? Wait, I'm going to suspend that aside and say that deep down inside all of those people, they never started out in business wanting to be that way. They became that way. Maybe it's, if they're a public company, it might be Wall Street that's causing them to be that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it may be their business school taught them things that are not relevant today.
They've had the curiosity beaten out of them over the years. I mean,
maybe, you know, if, you know, it's funny now having a whiskey company and working on corporate stuff, because I tend to have my whiskey with me. And so we end up, we taste, because we have to taste. And so when you're sitting there, you know, taking a sip of whiskey that you made, you know, with time compression very, very fast, that, you know, tastes amazing, it opens people up to conversations and dreams and that kind of stuff. And now what I find is that there's probably a good amount of curiosity, but the bigger issue is, okay, yeah, I can come up with ideas. But if our system can't do them, why bother? And so if you know your system is broken, now the bigger issue then may be not that they don't have curiosity, but that they don't believe that their organization can do anything with those ideas. I think that's the root cause. I think they don't have a method. You know. Remember Deming would always rant, by what method? By what method? You know, he wasn't big on lofty thoughts. You know, some of these management by objective people would throw numbers, he would say, by what method? You know,
that's my favorite quote. It is my favorite Deming quote. By what method? It struck me. Yeah.
And the answer is no. What I've just asked you for is I need 20% ROI and I need to achieve this within 18 months. And there, I've done my job. Go. And I'll bribe you a 50% bonus if you achieve it. And if not, I'll fire you. Go. I've done my job. Congratulations. Congratulations, numbnuts. That's not helpful to anybody. You know, by what method? You are looking, you've got the view. Where do you want us to go? Where do you want us to focus our time and energy? That's, you know, what are we betting on? In my case, I believe custom whiskey is going to be the future. I believe that organizations, while Rent-A-Guru with Eureka Inventing is popular today, it still is. I think in the future, people are going to want to put it inside, which is why we invest in education and tools. They're going to want to have their own people. It's going to be hard enough to get people. You're going to want to get your best return. People are going to want custom whiskey instead of Johnny, Jimmy's, and Jack's whiskey, you know?
Well, Johnny this Walker, is, yeah, and
Jimmy
this is,
B,
yeah.
And Jack Daniels.
Yeah. But this is the reason why you're investing so much in education. I mean, as far as the online fundamentals course and some of the things here is because you're making more. You're making others that can think and develop and actually tap into their own curiosity and know how to do something with it.
And I bet. And me and Maggie Nichols, who's now the CEO, as I'm the chairman now, we've bet that that's the future. That's where future growth is to do that. That's what leaders do. They make choices. They make choices. And so, but if you don't believe in your system, listen close. If you don't believe your system can execute it, and I said system, not people, because they'll say people and they change the people and it's just as bad. It's a system. It's a thinking system. If you don't believe your cultural system can execute it, then you sub-optimize your strategic choices because you're only practical and prudent and proper when you do it.
But
because
you're
safe. Just realistic.
Yeah, you're but it's realistic. Safe. I mean, that's what most people in, you know, Wall Street, has a tendency to push executives to be safe.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Any other final comments on how the pace of business has really changed?
No, just recognize that, folks, it is different. It is different. It is faster. It's not just your imagination. It truly is. And this is a good thing. This is a good thing. But if what you're doing today is the same as it was a year ago, you're dying, you just don't know it. So let's get going. What are you waiting for? Let's go.
This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we're going to take you behind the scenes on what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company like has never been done before. Doug, we've talked about different things associated with the Brain Brew whiskey, and let's talk a little bit about some of the key secrets that you've learned.
Well, so we've talked about the research quite a bit over the last couple of weeks. We've talked about some of our, you know, single product tests, looking to get a 7 in meaningful uniqueness. We've talked about paired comparison tests and the importance of paired comparison tests. One of the things that's important as you do that research, especially in the early cycles, when you get to big decisions, you want to have independent people doing it. But in the beginning, it's valuable if you run the tests, if you go up to people at bars, if you do it at your distillery, and you're asking them the questions. Because there is a feedback loop that you get. And one of the things that we've learned as we've been doing this, and this applies to the craft whiskey business, but it would also apply to many other industries. You know, only 18% of the population, we know from good data, drink whiskey. Of people who drink alcohol, only 18% drink whiskey. However, what we found qualitatively first, I remember John Muldoon and I, we went up to a table and we asked the people, would you like to try our whiskey? We've got a whiskey company. And one guy said, yes, absolutely. And the others, you could see them kind of like go, they kind of like pulled back. And of course, the loudmouth said, yes, taste for everybody. You know, like he's paying or something, you know. It's like crazy. And so we're doing samples with them, just having a little tiny taste, and they're tasting the product. And there were different products, one of which was a real classic, you know, pretty strong tasting one, and one was a very easy drinking product. And sure enough, you know, loudmouth loves the big tasting and thinks the other one's kind of wimpy. And all of a sudden, the eyes light up around the table, and the other people go, and there's like five other guys there, and they go, damn, that's pretty good. I like that whiskey. That's the first whiskey I've had I liked. And there were five of them now instead of one of him. So they started to then take over the conversation. And I realized, John and I talked right after we said it. We said, let's go look in the data. And sure enough, we find in the data that of people that have had whiskey in the past month, sort of a hardcore group. But then there's another segment of people who have whiskey once or twice a year. And then you got the people who haven't had it in the past year. So we've got the people who drink it, people who don't drink it, and then there's this big group of people in the middle who once or twice a year try it. And we called them kind of whiskey wannabes. They want to drink whiskey, but they don't like it. It's just too hard to drink. And so we started to focus on those people to see what would happen. And sure enough, it's a wonderful group of people that when you light them up with the right cues from a product and a packaging and from the way you're talking about the products and the products that you design, they like them. And so these are new whiskey drinkers. And that's kind of cool that in this old, old category called whiskey, you could find a growth market, not just in higher prices, but in new customers that you could bring to whiskey.
So this is your kind of your thinking behind growing this 18% of the whiskey drinkers into a larger piece of the pie by using these craft cocktails. That's part of the strategy anyway. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. So related to this is cocktails. So I can make a whiskey they can do, but the easier on-ramp, even easier, that gets the masses of the people is if I do cocktails. And so we're really focusing on developing a cocktail. But the problem is that your hardcore people, you know, watch too many John Wayne movies. Right? Yeah, I'm going to have it neat. You know?
The Westerns, yeah. They go into the bar.
They apologize for the fact that they want to put ice in the product or water in it. I'm like, for crying out loud, when I'm in Scotland, everybody adds water or ice. Everybody does. It's a North American craziness thing. Oh, yeah, it's a manly thing. It's a manly thing to take alcohol at too high of an APV, percent alcohol, and burn out our throats. Yeah, that's a cool thing to do. I mean, that's nuts. It's nuts. Now, the problem is for many whiskeys, the minute you add ice to it or water to it, the flavor drops off, especially the bourbons. The bourbons do this really badly. They'll fall off really quickly. So when we use our time compression, we use 22% more wood, square inches of wood, per bottle of liquid. It's basically the ratio. It's basically more wood. And then we change the compression cycles. And the net result is when you taste the Brain Brew whiskeys, what happens is they actually get better as time goes on. For about 7 minutes, if you just keep tasting it, they get better. And then they start down. And in about 15 minutes is when they start to fall. And after 15 minutes, if you had a nice glass of whiskey, you should be drunk, have drank it. I'm just saying.
So let's, and I am just curious, Doug, about this whole ice thing. Where did it come from? I mean, I definitely remember this being, you know, a topic conversation. Oh, you don't put your you know, ice in your whiskey at all, or that type of thing. And you're saying in Scotland that they do.
Yeah. Mostly they'll have water. Water and ice will come on the side, and you'll add your own. And they do. In fact, when they make whiskeys, they'll dilute it down. Because you can't taste it at that high percent alcohol. It's just this. It's just crazy. Only old people whose taste buds are burnt out really are, you know, I'm exaggerating for effect, because these younger people like to do it too. But the fact is that it is a much more pleasurable drink, and people mess up the fact that they've had a couple of drinks and then they have another one. And they keep tasting it because they're getting it stronger and stronger because their taste buds are numb. But the truth of the matter is I virtually never will drink it straight. Virtually never. Now, there's a little trick that you can do, though. If you're with a crowd, and I learned this from the Highland Park ambassador. Excuse me. I learned this from Jerry, who was a Highland Park ambassador.
So what is that? What is an ambassador? What does that mean?
A brand ambassador for Highland Park whiskey, which is my favorite Scotch whiskey. Okay. It's also made by our partner, full disclosure, Edrington, which has Macallan and that, distribute our products. So just full disclosure. But I love the product before I started to work with them. And I said, well, what do you do if it's this? Well, he says, in America, when I'm in America and they want to do it, and it doesn't seem right, and I'm with some people, he says, what you do is this. You take a little sip of whiskey, and then you kind of chew it in your mouth. You let the kind of saliva go, and that dilutes it down. So now it makes it drinkable. So, in fact, that's what we do is when we're tasting whiskey, sometimes when we're going quickly, what we'll do is we'll take a little sip and we'll chew it in our mouth to get a sense of the taste of the body. And then of course, we spit out because you just can't keep consuming because your judgment goes quickly. and so we do it that way. But generally, I always have it with ice. That's how I drink whiskey. And so I designed Brain Brew products to be particularly great with ice, because that's how I like it. Damn it.
So
we have a craft company, is we make what we like. You know?
Yeah. So in the eighth episode, you talked about the martini, and you were very very particular about how to make it. Is it the same thing for
same thing?
Okay. So how
with the martini, it's very careful how you shake it,
yep.
Boston shaker, amount of time, and because what you're doing is you're getting to the proper dilution. It's the exact same thing.
Okay.
It's the exact same thing.
So what is the proper?
And I got to tell you, at 7 minutes with ice, with whiskey in it, at 7 minutes with our whiskeys in particular, they're spectacular. They're spectacular.
At 7 minutes.
That's the best time. That's the best taste.
Okay. And then it starts to deteriorate after 7 minutes, I would guess. Yeah, that's kind of the peak.
Yeah, it goes down a little bit. But it really is. You want to have it with ice. You want to have it with ice.
All right. That I keep learning something new every time from you. So let's move on to our craft cocktail recipe that you have this week. The Sazerac. Did I pronounce that correctly?
The Sazerac, yes. And so this is one, and I'm just going to tell you up front, you're either going to love it a lot or not.
Mm.
Okay. And when we talk about great cocktails with bartenders, the Sazerac is one of those really high-end cocktails that is it's thought to be one of the originals. Sometimes it's made with brandy and whiskey. It started originally created with cognac. Today it's made with whiskey. It's a big sipping cocktail and is from New Orleans and best enjoyed listening to Dixieland jazz of Louis Armstrong, Pete Fountain, or the PRBB, which is the Presumpscot River Bottom Boys. And as a special bonus, my dad helped find that band and they were up in Maine, and we've got their a link to their second album that you can download the MP3s so that you can hear this music. And I think, Tripp, I gave you the link to that.
Yeah, and so you drink a Sazerac and you listen to this music.
Listen.
Is that required? Is that part of the formula?
So what you're going to do is you're going to drink the Sazerac, you're going to put the music on, and it's going to take you to Preservation Hall down in New Orleans, and where you're sitting there on the benches and listening to some of the greatest music. Dixieland jazz is one of those great music forms in that there is a basic theme, but each one of the musicians, when they take the lead, is playing riffs and playing different things, and it's never the same. It is got a discipline and a creativity at the same time, which to me is just, it's just magical music. And I grew up with it because my dad played trumpet. And so I grew up with this. And so this is one. I have sat in New Orleans, by the way, at Pete Fountain's place. He's a clarinet player. And drank maybe a couple of extra Sazeracs, enjoying it. So it is something.
Okay. So tell us about the drink then.
Okay. So first off, it's got absinthe in it, which is a licorice type taste. Pernod is one, and Herb Saint is one, which is the sort of the official one from down there, which sometimes you can find, sometimes you can't. Pernod is what you can find easily. You're going to pour a little bit in a rocks glass, and you're going to tilt the glass to really cover the whole insides of the glass, and then you're going to dump it out. Then you're going to add ice and a teaspoon of simple syrup, and this is basically a 50-50 mixture of sugar and water that you've made.
Okay, so you're making the simple syrup, because when I hear syrup, I think of maple syrup.
Yeah, simple syrup. It's a mixture of sugar and water.
So okay,
it's
all right.
You're going to put 1 teaspoon in.
Okay.
And then you're going to add 1.5 to 2 ounces of, in our case, my Noble Oak rye whiskey, or your local craft whiskey, but I like Noble Oak rye for this. We also have another product, which is a deckhand, working man's 5-wood rye, that'll be out soon, that is particularly amazing with this as well. And then you're going to add a lemon twist and 2 drops of Peychaud bitters. And the Peychaud bitters are a unique type of bitters that comes from New Orleans. And then stir it a lucky 13 times and enjoy.
13 times. You don't shake it.
No, you don't shake it. Only the martini do we shake. Only the martini. And when we get into some of the tropical drinks, the tiki drinks, then we're going to shake those because we want to have the foam and stuff in them.
Ah, so. Okay. And I'm sure there's chemical reasons why we want to do that too.
Culinary reasons.
Okay, we'll go with that. Now, we're going to have to raise this to another level. And speaking of the culinary reasons, what are the snacks that you have with these things? We could really expand this, Doug. We have a whole smorgasbord.
We could, but this is something where I don't want any other tastes in my mouth when I'm having my Sazerac.
Really?
This is not something that I'm going to have with food. I'm going to enjoy this and savor it just like the martini. I'm going to savor and sip it. I'm not going to put other stuff in because I want to enjoy. This has got amazing complexity to it, and there's a lot of magic in this taste. And when you get a proper Sazerac, it is a work of art. Interestingly, at a craft bar, when you order a Sazerac, your odds of getting a good one are pretty high. Now, if you say Sazerac and the bartender says, "What's that?" you know the answer is stop. Okay. But if you say Sazerac and they go, "Got it," and they kind of smile, what you know is it's one of their favorites. So they've got really good ingredients with it because it's one of the drinks they have at the end of the night.
Mm.
And so it's a pretty good odds that you're going to get a good Sazerac at a decent bar because it's likely that the other one's Negroni. Which is a gin drink, which we'll talk about another time. But the Negroni, Sazerac, these are ones that oftentimes bartenders really like. And so they'll tend to nurture them and they'll take extra care in it. They'll make it the way they like it. And it'll tend to be pretty good.
Okay, great. Well, that's you are definitely giving me a whole list of drinks that either I've had and now I have to make them, quote unquote, the Doug way, or once I've Sazerac, I had never even heard of it, and I may be in the minority, but that was certainly one that I'm not familiar with. So I'll definitely have to give that one a try. I'm still looking for the Lenny the stores. Yeah. I can't even find it. I'm around here anyway. I'll have to keep looking to see if I can find that. You said I'd have to brush the dust off of it anyway, so. I got to find out for that drink.
You'll find it. They've got it at Party Source just over in Kentucky. So sometimes when you're down here to Cincinnati, we can do it.
All right, very good. All right, well, that concludes our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment, and we will look forward to talking to you the next time.
Have fun, folks.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for a limited time four things. A 1 hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book, a subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions, and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.DougHall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.